Hey everybody, welcome to our weekly webinar, Restaurant Heist AP Session 2020. Our theme this week is Don't Stop Believing Us. You heard that audio, is like you're right there in concert. Great sound on these Zoom calls. If any of you have had the pleasure of seeing Journey in concert over the last several years, you will understand the lessons that Steve Perry taught us. One, don't quit your day job. And don't let a karaoke sing take your place in Journey, and don't stop believing. So that's what we're here to do today, is stay true to our mission in the restaurant space, is keep moving ahead together and moving towards a stronger and brighter tomorrow. So really appreciate everybody taking your time to join the call today. Hope everybody had a phenomenal Memorial Day weekend and back and well-rested and ready to go. It's been an interesting week, as always, in the restaurant space, with a lot of new and exciting developments going on. We know everybody's been hard at work around the country, lots of folks getting back to reopening, and a lot of those in the process of starting to reopen. So thank you again for all your efforts, to all you're doing with your teams around the country. We've got a phenomenal program today. We'll have Congressman Blumenauer, who is going to talk about the Restaurants Act of 2020, which a number of you may have heard about. It's getting more attention and traction out there, as well as Dan Simons from Farmers Restaurant Group and Luke Holden of Luke's Lobster. We'll also have updates on the CARES Act and people issues, as well as an update on SB 939, which we talked about last week, the real estate bill. So, thank you all for joining the program, and we're going to jump right in and hopefully kick things off with Congressman Blumenauer. I'm not sure if he has joined yet. In fact, John, is the congressman on yet? I have not seen him arrive yet.
He's not on yet. I think he's having trouble with the link, so I am resending that now. But if someone else wants to kick off while we figure that out, that's
fine. Why don't we? Thank you, John. We will jump right in, and I'm going to. Pleased to introduce Dan Simons, owner of Farmers Restaurant Group. And so if any of you are familiar with Farmers Restaurant Group, which I know a number of you are, it is one of the most dynamic and successful restaurant groups in the country. Having been a customer and a fan for many years, I've always loved their approach to business. And for those of you who attended our Restaurant High event in DC in 2017, the United Taste of America came to the after party at Farmers and Distillers, which was just one of the most awesome experience of all time, where Bill Murray came in and brought the whole staff out on the dance floor and a big party, and the food and the drink, everything's amazing that Dan and his team do. Just, best in class in hospitality and everything. And also, what I've always appreciated about Dan and the Farmers Group is how innovative and proactive and dedicated they are to the space. And we'll hear about that right now. Welcome, Dan. Thank you for joining the program today.
Thank you, Riley. And thanks for having me on.
Well, Dan, for those that have visited restaurants, they know what I'm talking about, how you and your group operate. It's truly astounding what you're able to pull off with you and your team every day. But what I've also enjoyed is your voice, as a supportive voice of the restaurant industry and what you were doing before this crisis and during it. One of the things that I found interesting about your group is just kind of the history and the ownership. You touch on that a little bit. How's Farmers Restaurant Group owned, and what makes it different than some of the others?
Sure. So I have one partner, Michael Vakurovich, and we're the restaurateurs. And then our third partner is a group of American Family Farmers, the North Dakota Farmers Union, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's the representative organization of about 50,000 independent family farmers in North Dakota. So they own the company with us. They actually own more of the company than I do. And then we have a lot of other individual farmer investors and other farm organizations, the National Farmers Union and the Wisconsin Farmers Union and folks from Minnesota. And so from the very beginning, the goal was to put mission over profit, advocate for American family farmers, be a market maker in an influential way, try to spread the message while generating a good return and building a company that we could be proud of. So we're in year 12 and, you know, it was going great up until March 16th. And, you know, thanks for all the kind words in your description. I couldn't help but thinking as you were saying all that, yeah, actually, Riley, we are apparently just totally back to, we are now a tiny company in startup mode. Because, you know, COVID world has shrunk us way down, but we're in the fight and figuring out how to hopefully go from being a tiny company again to a reasonably sized one.
Well, and one of the things that I noticed, you know, you did not waste any time with evolution plans. And, you know, with one thing that I found particularly interesting, adapting to Founding Farmers Market and grocery. And also, for those that have not visited Farmers and Distillers, you know, you distill on site. And so you make spirits on site, and you transform your distillery into a producer of hand sanitizer. So talk a little bit about, you know, the grocery aspects and some of the ancillary business lines that you've been working on.
So, you know, like everybody, you know, the mid-March was, you know, kind of awful and a moment of truth of, you know, we were certainly knocked down and we decided, okay, are we going to be like knocked out? And we said, no, let's figure out how to reinvent ourselves quickly. So we didn't want to just kind of add provisions in an ancillary way. You know, we've got 10,000, 12,000 square foot restaurants with tons of culinary firepower with equipment in the kitchen, plus our distillery, plus our bakery. And so we said, hey, what can we do to create a long-term sustainable business model, since we weren't sure what was going to happen to our restaurants or the viability of being a restaurant? And so we said, great, let's transition the distillery to make hand sanitizer like almost everybody else, you know, figured out pretty quickly as well in the distilling world. And then we decided to just create the market and grocery as our goal was to get to 1,000 SKUs as quickly as we could, while simultaneously doing our restaurant menus for to-go and delivery. So that's the goal we set for ourselves. And, you know, it was just a Herculean team effort. And this is what everybody in the restaurant industry, I think, can relate to, which is there's a lot of awesome teams out there. So we really focused on competing against Whole Foods and Balducci's and Dean and DeLuca and, you know, the kind of the good bodegas and fresh food markets in the towns that we're in. We didn't just want to be a little sideshow. We said, how do we go head to head with these guys? And while I'm by no means saying that we actually are going head to head with them, you know, we've been able to rehire 300 people. And so it's working. And I actually am about, hopefully, to have an agreement with Whole Foods to carry our hand sanitizer. So don't tell them that I want to compete with them on market and grocery. They are a powerhouse retailer, and I'd be thrilled if they were retailing our sanitizer.
Well, and I was looking through your website. I mean, it's really impressive how you were able to pull this ordering platform together. I mean, how did, you know, that come together so quickly? And it looks, you know, really well thought out and professional.
You know, hats off here to a tech company called GoTab. The CEO is Tim McLaughlin. They just, you know, we called them. We'd explored things with them pre-COVID, but never used any of their tech for contactless payment. And then we started to use their stuff for our restaurant. And then we said, hey, we need an e-commerce platform to spin up this whole market. And I think like a good entrepreneur, he said, yeah, sure, we can do that. Because I think he quite couldn't envision that we would pull off what we pulled off. And so he's a restaurant guy. He worked side by side remotely, you know, with our folks 7 days a week to, you know, they had to switch to a new cloud provider to handle the volume, and they added tons of new coding and functionality. So we never could have done it without GoTab's partnership on that kind of speed and support. So that was a huge part of it. And then, you know, we kind of turned our marketing people into e-commerce managers, and we turned our head bartenders into category managers. Fortunately, my partner and I have some pretty good market, bakery, prepared foods experience in our background. And so we just dug deep and had to access kind of the corrupt hard drive that is my brain nowadays. And so it took some great partners like that, but GoTab is our e-commerce backbone right now.
Well, and when you look at, you know, your ordering platform, it looks like pretty awesome. I mean, you can, you know, get your you know, household grocery staples, and you can also get your delicious food. You know, it, so you can order all that kind of simultaneously, and your guests can kind of get the best of all worlds.
Yeah, so we set the goal when we started. We said, okay, we got to get to same day delivery of all of these SKUs. You know, that's what we're built to do, right? Same day, same moment delivery of the a la carte menu. We started with, we need 2 days notice. Then we got to, we need 24 hours notice. And as of last week, you can order same day. And within 2 hours, you can come pick up or we'll deliver your groceries. So, you know, restaurant people are just amazing. You can convert a server into a picker and packer. You can convert an expo into a curbside runner. And we just moved our tables and chairs out. And our dining rooms now look like like pick and pack warehouses, and our walk-ins look like, you know, almost like retail shelves with labeling. One of the hardest parts of the whole thing has been ingredient labels and packaging labels and, you know, compliance. And so that took a bit of time to get up. But yes, you can place a full order and you can get, you know, baked goods, and you can get a toilet bowl cleaner, and you can get hand sanitizer, and you can get a, you know, meal pack of rotisserie chicken and three sides for a family of four. And we really tried to keep our prices down on everything.
Wow. Well, it's really, and anybody that has not been on your website on the phone, I encourage you to check it out, because it is really cool. And I know that a lot of groups are out there and made some adaptation to grocery and so forth. I guess, where do you see kind of, you know, as things play out over the next several months, where do you see things headed for your business? And will grocery and perhaps be an enduring part of this? Or are you planning to make the full transition back to where you were? Or what are things looking like from your perspective?
Yeah, we don't see a transition backwards. So, and maybe this is just philosophy, you know, like we're looking forwards, and the new future that we see is some hybrid model that just allows us to be a more diversified and resilient kind of provider of food, beverage, and hospitality. We keep saying to our team internally, we're going to meet our customer and we're going to meet our guest wherever they want to be. So if they want to be sitting at a bar without a mask, and that's allowable by law, great, we'll meet them there. We've got bars, we've got dining rooms. If they want us to meet them at the curb, we'll meet them there. If they still want us to meet them at their home, we'll meet them there. And so that, I think, and finding new sales channels. So that's, for me, the entrepreneurial challenge. That's the future. Don't get me wrong. I am eager to see, you know, restaurants and bars and everything back open at 100%. But frankly, only when it's safe. Like, I think for my partner and I, we put the safety of the community above our, you know, short-term need. So that's kind of, you know, we're kind of on board with the science approach. At the same time, you know, it's desperate times without revenue. So I think the future for us, you'll see us continue to figure out how to sell and deliver prepared foods. You know, if you could come in for dinner on a Friday night, and while you're there, place a grocery order on your phone and we can deliver it to you right when you finish your dessert. You can walk out with 2 bags of your groceries. Sure. That means I got to figure out how to put trailers outside and I need ancillary storage. But, you know, we also think there's going to be plenty of empty real estate out there. So part of our approach to resiliency is like, we have to survive is desperate cash flow moments for us. So I think we're entrepreneurially optimistic, and we are day-to-day realistic with what we got to do to survive the fight.
Well, Dan, I really appreciate you spending some time with this. I'm going to ask everybody to kind of, I'm going to finish up everybody with a, you know, a Steve Perry journey question. I love your optimism. So why can you not stop believing, Dan, in the restaurant industry?
You know, we just have the best people. There's so much heart, you know, and I think that we all have people who, you know, for one reason or another, don't qualify for unemployment insurance or slip through the, you know, social safety net. And, you know, our people need us, our communities need us, and we've got teams that know how to fight. So, you know, I look at that recipe and I say, okay, it's going to be a hard fight, but with the recipe of the people and the heart we have, there's no way I'm going to stop believing. Plus, Riley, I don't know how to do anything else. So, you know, like, like it's got to work because this is what my partner Mike and I, what we do.
Well, Dan, thank you so much. Love what you and your team are doing. For everybody on the phone, if you haven't checked it out already, check out what Farmers Restaurant Group is up to. It's really impressive. We appreciate you being at the heart of the battle, as always, as you've been before and during and will be along the way. So if anybody has questions for Dan and team, feel free to send them through the portal. And I can't thank you enough for spending time with us today, Dan.
Oh, my pleasure. I look forward to continuing to listen and keep learning from the other folks you have.
Well, thanks again, Dan. And now I'm pleased to jump into next part of the program is to welcome Congressman Blumenauer. Now, Congressman Blumenauer, I feel very lucky to have him because he's in my district here in Portland, Oregon, Portland native like myself, and was so excited to see his name attached to the Restaurants Act of 2020, the bill that's making a lot of waves and getting a lot of attention. It's proposed as a $120 billion restaurant stabilization fund. And as everybody on this call knows, I mean, we all know that additional financial support outside of the PPP is really needed to help a lot of folks get through this, in addition to some other things. And any bill with credible people behind it that supports the ongoing existence of restaurants is, you know, a great thing from our opinion. And really appreciate Congressman Blumenauer putting his efforts behind this. So Congressman Blumenauer, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Riley. I appreciate the invitation. And it was a pleasure for me to discover that we have such a great resource in our own backyard with the work that you've done on the West Coast and nationally. I appreciate the work that is that you're focusing on. In fact, we've already had some interaction about the draft that we're moving for the legislation. As you mentioned, the draft would put $120 billion into a grant program for restaurants through the end of 2020. We've tried to cure the problems that the PPP proposes. I mean, it's too short a time frame. It's too restrictive. It's not flexible enough. And so we've been working with the Independent Restaurant Coalition over the course of the last 6 weeks to have a proposal that would fill that gap. We have, we're going to be introducing it soon. There is available a white paper and a concept that can be obtained through my office for people to review. Look forward to working with interested parties on further refinement. This is, we've moved it in this direction to be able to get something in bill form. Things with the speed that we're seeing proposals being generated, it's really a challenge to be able to move it through the legislative bureaucracy for drafting. We've had it in the queue now for 16 days, and we hope to break it loose soon, but we're having people operate on the basis of the white paper and the concept. We've had several dozen members already want to be a part of it. We're advancing the concept. I've discussed it with the speaker, with Democratic leadership. We need to make sure that the next round of activity includes major relief the restaurant industry. We cannot afford to have the independent restaurants that are really the anchor of our communities in my hometown of Portland, Oregon, but around the country. It's not just 11 million jobs and a half million enterprises. These really are the heart and soul, and it's a path forward for so many immigrants. It's a way that we connect, and it's a way that we build community. Our proposal is designed to be able to fill that gap, to be able to have the resources that people need for the remainder of the year. Candidly, as this goes forward, we might want to make some adjustments in terms of larger and more generous. But the point is, we need a marker. We need something to rally around. We need something that gives a point of departure to make sure that the next major piece of legislation that passes the House has relief for restaurants. There is a number of different vehicles. As people on the call may know, the House passed the HEROES Act, $3 trillion that has been sent over to the Senate. But this is a piece of legislation that can be reviewed as sort of the opening bid. It's not going to be passed in exactly this form. There's going to be back and forth. We've already seen the Senate leadership, which was very dismissive originally, now being open to one of the major pieces in this legislation dealing with local government, education, and state government. This is going to be an inner process. Support is going to build over time for these essential elements. And we need to make sure, whether it's part of the negotiation right now with the Senate or whether it's the next piece of legislation that goes forward, there is a tailored proposal to deal with stabilizing the restaurant industry. We invite people to review our material. Riley, we'll continue. You've provided some useful feedback. We look forward to working with you and people on this call to be able to refine it. But most important, we look forward to getting people mobilized behind a vehicle that will be a placeholder in whatever legislation passes. I think we're going to see one or two major pieces of legislation coming forward. We need to make sure we've laid the foundation so that tailored support for the restaurant industry is in it, and a minimum of $120 billion to stabilize it so we don't have massive losses of business and more unemployment of these 11 million workers.
Well, thank you, Congressman. And that's just great background. And, you know, for those that have not read the white paper yet or seen it, I will circulate that to the group after the call. But there is a lot of really good stuff in here. You know, and as you said, there will be refinement. There always is. But at the heart of this is something, you know, incredibly important. It is supporting the heart of the American restaurant industry. And even the larger groups that are on this call, you know, that may, as drafted, you know, be outside of what's currently proposed in numbers of locations and so forth. Every restaurant group in the country at some point started small and, you know, had to get the support to grow. And as you said, the jobs that are created by this industry are so significant and so important, you know, the fabric of you know, every community, that to get legislation that supplements or improves upon, you know, the challenges with the PPP funding, you know, is it essentially essential, and the timeliness is critical, as so many groups around the country right now are deciding whether or not to move forward. I mean, we've seen, you know, groups in pretty much every city, you know, over the last few weeks that have decided, you know what, it's not worth it, or we don't think we can make it. And, you know, the importance of getting those the support needed, you know, so that they make the decision to stay in business and move forward is absolutely critical. You know, Congressman, just, you know, a question myself and maybe others on the call, we learned about passing a bill through Schoolhouse Rock or other programs. it's no easy task for you or anyone else to get something shepherded from, you know, idea to the finish line. For those that are on the phone, I guess, how can we, you know, help support you, you know, in this process to get this from idea to some form of finalization as quickly as possible?
Riley, that is the essence of my concern and what we want to engage people. The way that we're going to get this legislation passed is if we're able to focus people's attention around the country on the need for a major investment in restaurant stabilization. As I say, we've included $120 billion as the top line number. I would not be disappointed at all if there was more that is allocated to it. We need to make sure that we insist that any major piece of legislation that moves forward, either in the interaction with the Senate now on legislation that's already passed, the HEROES Act, or whether it's the next round of legislation, the bottom line is we need to insist that there is a tailored provision for restaurants. We need to make sure that it is more flexible than the PPP. Having Zoom calls in every congressional district, bringing together people who care about the survival of American restaurants and the entrepreneurial spirit and the 11 million people who work in them is absolutely essential. There are all sorts of calls that are taking place on a regular basis. We need to make sure that we just don't have people talking to each other, but that we expand that conversation, and that in these calls that we have, that we include men and women who staff members of the House and Senate. They need to be a part of the conversation. Indeed, I would extend invitations to members of Congress and the Senate to find out what they're willing to do to encourage them to support our Restaurants Act and making sure that they make space in final legislation to assure the continuation of restaurants. We need to have 6 to 8 months of stability and more going forward. We need more flexibility than the PPP. I hope that people will have calls like this around the country, widening the circle, including more to be a part of it, looking at the legislative concepts and building momentum. This needs to happen before the 4th of July. Things are going to be settled, and at some point it's going to be too late to be able to save a number of folks. They're going to give up. They're going to, I think, be discouraged. They're going to have different business models. So this is, I think, our challenge over the course of the next 5 weeks or so, to be able to have these conversations in every single congressional district around the country. Broadening the circle is key. We need to move from angst to action.
Well, Congressman, couldn't agree more that you know, it's so important for those to rally behind legislation that you know, advances this cause. And there's obviously talk of a lot of different things going on at any given time, but you know, at some point you have to pick a horse to ride. And by all accounts, this is looking like a good one, at least from my personal perspective. And, you know, who's behind it, what's at the heart of it, the size of the bill, and the willingness to be flexible and guided by you through what can be a very complicated process. You know, we held, you know, the United Taste of America for Restaurant High, which you were a part of in 2017, in which we rallied bipartisan support for our food and job fair. And I know you kicked it off with Kim Malik over at Salt and Straw, and you and your colleagues on the other side of the aisle love restaurants. They love food. And, you know, is it, you know, from your perspective, you must be pretty enthusiastic about the prospect of finding bipartisan support, I would imagine. Do you think that's possible here?
we've already had some conversations with folks on the other side of the aisle. I mean, this is the most polarized environment any of us have ever seen in American politics. But when we talk about being able to support a quintessential American industry, you know, that going back to the founding fathers, mostly, sadly, they were fathers, but some of the founding mothers were innkeepers, you know, where the Constitution was hammered out. This is where America was founded and how America grew. So I'm convinced that we can build on the basis of bipartisan support now, putting the question to each and every member of the House and Senate, what will they support? Will they put serious money behind a tailored rescue program? I think when the chips are down, I think people will be there. This does not have to be partisan when we want to save 11 million jobs and a half million enterprises. So I am pleased with my initial conversations, both House and Senate. But this is a role that we can all play to reach out and engage people to be behind this concept and work with us to refine it and advance it.
Well, Congressman Blumenauer, I can't thank you enough for spending time with us today and for your efforts behind this bill. I will pass along the white paper to all on this call, as well as contact information for you and your office, if that's okay. We've got a very broad and diverse group around the country here, and I know everybody is very interested and, you know, excited about what you are doing.
Well, we appreciate the help. We look forward to hearing from folks. John Bosworth has been the main author of this in my office. He's on this call, and we'll have his contact information too, and we'll look forward to building the base of support in the course of the month ahead so that we can rescue the American restaurant industry.
Well, thank you so much, Congressman. It's been an honor having you here with us today, and we look forward to many follow-ups on this topic and in the very near future. So thank you again.
Great. Thank you, Riley.
Okay. Talk to you soon. Well, and for all on this call, you know, lots of us are very immersed in a whole bunch of different initiatives at local, state, and the federal level. But as Congressman Blumenauer said, you know, it is important to, you know, rally behind, and ideally this legislation. You mentioned it's in draft form, and there will be, you know, a number of revisions that occur as it works its way through the process, is always the case here. I know we have some people on the call here today listening in that are very active in this, and, you know, those that may want to become active. So if you would like to be a part of this too, you know, feel free to reach out to me directly, and we're looking to do what we can to help provide passage of effective and outstanding legislation to provide the financial support needed in addition to the PPP to get through this. So with that, I'm very excited to introduce our next very special guest, Luke Holden of Luke's Lobster. For many of you on the phone, you're familiar with Luke's Lobster. I was initially introduced as a customer a number of years ago and found myself kind of blown away by how they could produce such high quality. I think, you know, somewhat, also price sensitivity. I'm like, how can they afford to sell such a great product and better, you know, at such a great price? And, you know, as I got to know Luke and team, I got to realize how they have a very unique and special business model, you know, which is able to do this, to expand to multiple states and over 30 locations, and also Japan over the period of what I guess it's been 11 years now. So Luke, it's great to have you on the call today.
Riley, thanks for having me.
So we call you the main man because we're using double entendres today, Luke, because you are from Maine, but also in terms of, you know, growing a highly differentiated concept in your space. I haven't seen anybody do anything close to what you and your team have pulled off. I guess kind of talk a little bit about kind of your, you know, the seafood model as how it's built into your restaurant program and how it differentiates you.
So I'm actually a third generation lobsterman. My father was he actually held the first lobster processing license here in the state of Maine. So I grew up on the back of boats, on the working waterfront, and in seafood production facilities. So that's very much ingrained in my background and upbringing. For us, when we started this business back in 2009, it was really about offering the super high quality products that my father was producing on a branded direct to consumer level. My family was typically just in the wholesale seafood manufacturing production business. And when I was in New York and doing investment banking, the true story is that I was sitting at my desk on a summer Sunday afternoon, missing home. And I went online looking for something that reminded me of home. And that was a traditional Maine style lobster roll. And there was nothing like it in the city. It was all a mayo-filled, overpriced white tablecloth type product that just didn't equate to what I grew up with. So we opened a very small lobster shack out of a 250 square foot formerly consignment shop, and we developed a brand that was based around getting super high quality seafood direct from our relationships with fishermen through our production facility into the hands of consumers and as quickly and as affordable manner as possible. You know, fast forward nearly 11 years, and we ended up building a production facility back in 2012 that could really work as a glorified commissary for the restaurant group. And also start to build a wholesale market. So pre-COVID, what our business looked like was about 30 restaurants in the U.S. and 10 internationally. That was about 50% of our sales, and the other 50% of our sales was wholesale distribution. In 2019, we actually earned the Global Supplier of the Year award for Whole Foods. So we have really grown that business over the last several years and started the last two years to get very heavy into the consumer packaged goods, where we're actually creating value-added seafood production kits and selling it into grocery. So we are really a vertically integrated group. We work almost exclusively with cooperatives of fishermen we bring into our production facility, add value, and sell it to those predominantly, again, before COVID, sell it through those two channels, the restaurant group and then consumer packaged good partnering resellers.
Yeah, and I know you've been working quite extensively on an e-commerce platform. Maybe expand a little bit on that.
Yeah, so it was something just to take a note from what Dan had shared earlier, and it's just remarkable how Dan has transformed his business in such a short period of time. We had to, people are probably our it's either our seafood or people who are our two biggest assets, and our teammates were just, They were looking for something in a downtime and a way to compete. And so we said, hey, you know, we've got all this inventory that we typically sell in the restaurant group, all this inventory that we typically sell through our wholesale partners, and we've got fishermen that still need to go out and harvest and still need to go out and sell their products, and we can't have these guys tie up. So Our team put together an effort to create an e-commerce distribution channel, and it's just been incredibly successful. And I think it's got durability for us as well. For us, like what our seafood production facility looks like, it's two 40,000 square foot production facilities. The campus has got a 10,000 square foot freezer and probably 10,000 square feet of refrigeration space. So we not only do we have production space, but we really do have distribution and fulfillment capability as well. So in addition to selling the products that we were traditionally selling through our old channels, we started linking up with fishermen and said, hey, what's the daily catch today? And what's the flavor of the season? And so we started with scallops, and that was a really incredible opportunity for us because we got the opportunity to work directly with these guys, selling what they were bringing across the docks currently, send it within 48 hours to our consumers, get them something that they couldn't get either in our restaurant or get through any of our partnering wholesale accounts. So that's where I think there's durability in this. Like right now, our fishermen are catching halibut. So we're bringing the halibut in, and we've got the expertise to cut and portion fish. And so it's I'll take two pounds of halibut steaks, and then while you're at it, I'll throw another three or four lobster and crab products in it that are typically what we produce. So it's been really interesting for us, and it's also been great for the morale for our team because we've been winning, and it's got a run rate right now doing more volume than any shack that we've ever had. And the team is like, in a time where like you look for those pick-me-ups, you look for those successes, the team is really in a way that's not distracting to our strategic plan to get this stuff reopened is been very successful, and that's just been really nice in managing a team right now.
Well, and I think what's really cool too is one, how you've diversified your business, but you know how you're doing things in a way. I mean, it's really cool. For those that have not been on Luke's website, I encourage you to do that and take a look through here. I know the lobster roll bundle, you know, that serves eight, you know, you can get that for $120, but if you went, you know, to a restaurant to purchase lobster rolls, you would be paying quite a bit more than that. You're getting, you know, a premium quality product, and you know, how quickly does that usually ship?
So we are shipping fresh lobster meat now 4 days a week. So you can order it on literally on Monday, and if it's before noontime, and receive it on Tuesday. So we've got a quick turnaround time on it, and those lobsters are either coming in Monday morning or Sunday night. So that's again where I think there's durability in the business for us, because there's a value proposition that is kind of unmatched in sort of some of our other distribution channels. So I'm super excited about it.
Well, you recently reopened, you know, for carry out and to go some of your shacks. Didn't you open like five in the last week?
We did. Yep. We opened one in Boston. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Riley.
Oh, and how's that going so far?
It's been going, I would say, fair. We opened one in Boston, two in New York, one in DC, and one in Philadelphia, and the restaurant team, they did an incredible job thinking through safety from a guest and teammates perspective, and that's our number one priority. And then second priority, just quality, and that's quality of experience from both our teammate and guest perspective. And so it was super charged up in how they were to execute those two priorities. The third has just been building a durable business, and sales were fine. They were probably halfway between when we decided to close end of March and what they were last year. So like our shack in Brooklyn Bridge Park was absolutely insane and rivaled last year numbers. But one of our tourist-based locations in Boston, that is typically a great location for us, was down more significantly than than we probably expected. So we kind of have the concept of like a canary in the coal mines at play, and just going low and slow and making sure that safety is executed, quality is executed, and then trying to figure out what next steps are as we just get a little bit more data and a little bit more visibility into the future.
Well, Luke, I know you have many more locations ahead to come back to business, and you have obviously a ton on your plate, as does your team. So I really appreciate you taking some time out of your day to spend with us. And as I said with Dan, we're asking the Steve Perry journey question to wind up everybody here. What keeps you believing in the restaurant business?
So in addition to people, for us, it really is the supply chain. I mean, we are custodians of the catch of our fishermen. There's probably no more influential lobster buyer in the country than us at this point in time. And that is a huge responsibility that we take great ownership and great pride in. And so for us, like, we've got to get open. We've got to get markets built so that there's a business here for these guys to go fishing. Maine has kind of been ranked as one of the top five states that's going to likely be affected by COVID-19, because our two biggest industries are lobster, which is kind of anything but a commodity, and tourism. So for us, we look at ourselves as a staple in the supply chain, and we've got to do whatever we can to build strength there so that we can continue to keep the Maine economy as strong as possible.
Well, Luke, I'd like to thank you and your team for all that you're doing, you know, and all that you're doing for the industry, because I know you're active personally on many fronts. And for those on the phone that want to get a hold of you or take a look at the company, obviously look it online, and we'll send around contact information. But can't thank you enough for spending time with us today, Luke.
Thanks, Riley. And just, you know, one other thing that we're going to be exploring here is more B2B business as well. So as other restaurateurs get the opportunity to reopen their brands, if there is a need for seafood, especially lobster, given now that we've kind of built a pretty robust e-commerce business, we do have the flexibility of getting products to other restaurants and other restaurant groups without really making a complicated distribution model work. We can just go direct from B2B. So if there is that opportunity for anybody out there, we'd love hearing from you.
Well, thank you, Luke. And if it's okay with you, I will share your contact info in case anybody wants to reach out on that point.
Thanks, Riley.
All right. Well, thank you again, Luke. Have a great rest of the week. And with that, I'm going to jump into SB 939, a quick update here. We had Gwyneth Borden on last week and Senator Scott Wiener from the state of California talk about the bill to give restaurateurs the ability to terminate leases without penalty under certain conditions if they were unable to negotiate a successful amendment to a lease or different provisions with their landlord. SB 939 was heard in the Judiciary Committee on Friday, and it did pass. The next stop is the Appropriations Committee in California, with any bill amendments due around June 11th. So there's obviously a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes on this. I know a number of on the phone are active in these conversations. So to the extent there are questions or you want to get involved, you can reach out directly, and we can put you in touch with Gwyneth and team who are leading these efforts with Senators Wiener and Gonzalez in California. And we know this is a controversial lightning rod piece of legislation, as do the proponents, but it is something that is bringing parties to the table on the real estate side to further engage in meaningful discussions on a path forward between landlords and tenants and banks and all the way up to the government. So SB 939 is alive and moving ahead. So with that, we're going to move into CARES Act updates. And as we talked about with Congressman Blumenauer, the CARES Act has been really confusing and complicated and not well tailored for the restaurant industry. Nevertheless, a lot of those on the phone have received funds and have dealt with all the fun and games and working through this. And there are some more updates to pass along. So Liz and Landis, welcome. What's going on with the CARES Act? And it sounds like,
Liz,
I know there's something because there was updates since, 11 o'clock on Friday night or something like that, before Memorial Day weekend. Nice timing.
Yeah, great timing. So there's two interim final rules that were put out around midnight on Friday. And one was addressing the forgiveness loan application that was put out about a week earlier. And then the other was just kind of on the process of how the SBA will review PPP loans for forgiveness as well as lenders. And I'm gonna quickly, for the most part, the interim final rule tracked the application and the instructions pretty closely, but I was just gonna highlight a couple things that takeaways from the guidance. And then Landis is gonna kind of go over kind of the guidance on the process for submitting a loan application. So the rule made clear that a question that people have been wondering as to what counts for an eligible payroll cost when it comes to paying out employees bonuses, hazard pay during the covered periods. And they've made clear that bonuses, hazard pay, as well as salaried wages and commission payments to furloughed employees are eligible payroll costs, but they will be subject to that $100,000 annual salary cap as prorated during the covered period. So that's good news. Also, as something that came up during the loan application was that for owner compensation, in addition to that $100,000 cap, there's also an additional cap of 8/52 of 2019 compensation across all businesses. And so for owner employees, they're saying that eligible payroll costs are capped at that amount of their 2019 employee cash compensation and also their employer retirement and healthcare contributions made on their behalf. Whereas for Schedule C filers and general partners, there's no additional forgiveness provided for retirement or health insurance contributions, as such expenses are paid out of their net self-employment income. There's also was more guidance on how the FTE reduction exemption would work for those employees that you try to rehire during the covered period who declined the offer to be rehired. They added this exemption for employees who declined reemployment offer or for employees whose hours have been cut and businesses offer to restore the hours and they decline. So you won't be penalized in either of these situations. They did add an obligation. In order to use this exemption, borrowers will have to inform the applicable state unemployment insurance office of such employees' rejected offer for reemployment within 30 days of the employee rejecting the offer. So they basically added a provision where you have to tell on an employee if they reject to be rehired. In addition to the rehire exemption, there's also no penalty or there's no reduction for employees that were fired for cause, resigned, or requested reduced hours. So when doing the FTE reduction calculation, there will be no penalty for those situations. One additional thing that they clarified in the rule was that there's two reductions, one for FTE reductions and one for salary and wage reductions. And the regs confirmed that there will not be a double penalty. So to the extent, the salary wage reduction won't apply to the extent that that reduction's already being caught in the FTE reduction, which makes sense. Landis, are you on, and do you want to go over the forgiveness application?
I am, yes. Thank you, Liz. Yes, so in addition to the guidance they provided that Liz summarized on Friday night, they also provided additional descriptions in the review process for the individual loans and the timing and procedures for that. So the SBA clarified that they may review any PPP loan at any time for the following things. So for borrower eligibility, the loan amounts being correct, the use of proceeds, and the loan forgiveness amount. So if they decide to undergo a review before you request the forgiveness amount, nothing stopping them from doing that. They clarified that borrowers are required to retain documentation in their files for 6 years after the date the loan is either forgiven or repaid in full. So either way, you have to keep all the documents for 6 years. If the SBA undertakes a review, the SBA will notify the lender in writing, and the lender must notify the borrower in writing within 5 business days of receipt. So you you would know if within 5 business days after the lender has received their notification. If the SBA has notified the lender that the SBA has commenced a loan review, the lender shall not approve any application for loan forgiveness for such loan until the SBA has concluded their review, of course. So they provided that the borrowers will have the opportunity to respond to SBA's questions and requests for additional information in a review. So it won't just be a conversation between the lender and the SBA directly, but the borrower will have the opportunity to respond because it's ultimately your financial liability. If the SBA determines a borrower is ineligible for PPP loan, such borrower's loan forgiveness application will be denied. Also, they determine that the loan forgiveness amount claimed by the borrower is not proper. The SBA will direct the lender to deny the loan forgiveness application in whole or in part as appropriate. Now, this is particularly noteworthy. The non-recourse provisions of the CARES Act would not be available in the event a borrower is determined to be ineligible. So you'll recall the CARES Act says that the principals do not need to make any personal guarantees or the like on a PPP loan. If the SBA determines that the borrower was, absolutely ineligible, there is the chance that the lender could try to make the principal on the line because that they wouldn't be able to rely on that safe harbor under the CARES Act. The SBA may also seek repayment of the outstanding PPP loan balance or pursue other available remedies. The borrowers may appeal the SBA's determination of ineligibility for PPP loan or ineligibility for the loan amount or the loan forgiveness amount claimed. So there's still an appeals process if they make any adverse determination. Now, in terms of the timing of the process, for loan forgiveness applications that are not reviewed by the SBA prior to the lender's decision on the forgiveness application, the lender has 60 days upon receipt of a complete forgiveness application from borrower to issue a decision to the SBA regarding loan forgiveness. So if the SBA has not finished their review, the lender still needs to make their decision, and they have, once the borrower has requested, they have 60 days to do so. The decision may take the form of an approval in whole or in part, denial, or if directed by the SBA, a denial without prejudice due to a pending SBA review of the loan for which forgiveness was sought. The SBA will then, subject to any ongoing SBA review, remit the appropriate forgiveness amount to the lender, plus accrued interest, within 90 days. In the case of a denial without prejudice, the borrower may subsequently request that the lender reconsider its application for loan forgiveness, unless the SBA has determined that the borrower is ineligible for PPP loan. Within 30 days of notice from the lender, a borrower may request that the SBA review the lender's decision. So, in other words, let's say your individual lender determines that you are ineligible or you are only eligible for a smaller amount, you could appeal from your lender itself to the SBA and say, no, you basically tell your bank that they're being too conservative and that the SBA itself would allow it. So you could appeal to them. So there's another bite in the apple there. So overall, it's a generally reasonable process. You get multiple bites of the apple to to make sure that you're completely compliant with it. The SBA still made sure to retain that they have some teeth in it for if there's the ultimate termination of ineligibility or at least part, you know, with respect to some of the amounts. But no huge surprises in this process, but we just want to make sure you're aware of it.
Well, thank you, Landis and Liz. I think this really kind of highlights how complicated and painful it is to take money from the SBA involving government. That's for sure. And that's why other legislation that more of a grant process could be, you know, and less complicated, be really, really welcome, because, you know, there's going to be more to come on the CARES Act and PPP funding. But, it gets further along, gets further into the details, realize that there's going to be more scrutiny and more everything, as you often find in these situations. So hopefully we have some good legislation coming up soon that provides relief without so many, you know, hooks and without so much complexity. But thank you both for the update, and we'll finish up here with some people updates. If there's anything of significance going around the country on the employment labor front, we are covering that for you here. Why don't we check in with Roy in New York? Roy, any updates in New York?
Hey, Raleigh. In New York, there's not any real breaking news or breaking updates. Long Island and Westchester County are going to be entering phase one of the reopening. I think tomorrow or Thursday. So that'll mean that curbside retail, manufacturing, wholesale trade, things like that are going to be able to open subject to some pretty strict regulations. And then we'll move from there. Thus far, there's no a region in New York that is in phase two yet, and restaurants are in phase three. So we'll continue to monitor it. And then the Essential Workers Bill of Rights in New York City, which deals with just cause discharge regulations and hazard pay, same as last week, is still working its way through the system. We're monitoring all of these things, and we'll report, once there is news.
Well, thank you very much, Roy. In California, Janet, any key updates on the employment labor front in California?
There really isn't anything very new here in California today. The big news is, I suppose, the Justice Department pointing to the mayor here in Los Angeles saying he's overreaching with his closures, and so we'll see how that develops. But nothing particularly new on that at this point. So continuing along.
Well, I guess no news is good news on the labor front in California, as always.
That would be a good thing. Definitely a good thing.
A reminder to everybody on the phone, if you're onboarding, strongly consider at-will employment agreements with class action waivers and arbitration clauses. If you're not using them, you know, our team can help with those, but can save you a lot of headache and money, especially in California, in New York, but elsewhere.
Absolutely.
Around the country. So a quick plug there. Try not to do that too much, but really, really important. thank you, Janet. Jillian, great state of Washington. I know, you know, they've into phases of reopening there. How are things going on the employment front in Washington?
Hi, Riley. Well, I had an exciting weekend because I live in Spokane, Washington, and we did enter into phase two. So I actually went to two restaurants and got to sit there and have a server come over and bring me stuff. So it was very exciting. I just thought I'd share a little bit about how the restaurants I went to are handling things. At the one kind of near my house, the host met us outside. She said that we needed to wait to be seated. They didn't want folks coming in. They had actually posted something on their Facebook earlier about if you needed to wait for a table, you'd be asked to wait in your car. But we actually were able to be seated in their newly expanded patio. So they got clearance to open a whole other side of their sidewalk area to have that be patio seating, because the inside I did peek in there. I went to the restroom in there, and they had closed down a lot of their inside seating. So they had expanded patio seating. I will say it wasn't quite as charming as their regular patio that has flower boxes and cute lights and whatnot. It was sort of just literally like police barricades, sort of in a kind of somewhat sterile environment, but it was still really nice. to be served. One of our favorite servers came over, was wearing a face mask. We both sort of remarked that this was really odd, but they had one of those barcodes taped to the center of all the tables. And so you pulled up the menu by just using your smartphone, the iPhone, if you just pull up the camera feature, not even like the barcode scanner feature, it just pulled their menu right up, slightly smaller menu. They had table tents instructing folks to not go inside unless they needed to use the restroom and not to walk around a bunch inside. But other than that, I mean, it was a little bit odd, but it was really nice to be back. I went to another restaurant a day or two later, and it's kind of a similar drill, although I did actually sit inside. We had a bigger party, but they allowed us to split up. So we set our little kids to the table next to us, because you can only have five people at the table in Washington. And so they had hand sanitizer when you walked in. Again, sort of a smaller menu. They also used that barcode. They said if folks couldn't pull that up, they did have some single-use menus. Again, everybody was wearing masks, sort of odd, but it was nice to be back in a restaurant. And so I'm looking forward to kind of going to a few more of my favorites. And if I hear of anything interesting, or if I experience anything interesting, I'll certainly share next week on how folks are handling this.
Well, thank you so much, Jillian, and glad you're able to get out, and really happy to hear folks are getting back at it in some semblance, even if a little odd. So thank you for the update, Jillian.
And
Jenna, anything going on in Oregon? I know phase is opening is getting back here. Anything new to report?
Nothing real new to report. What I'm seeing a lot of is employers having a hard time getting their employees to come back. And struggling with the fine line between reporting on your employees to unemployment, which unemployment has been asking people to do, and not wanting to create a disgruntled former employee who becomes desperate and wants to come after you. So there's certainly a struggle there for employers to get people to come back and help them reopen. And so I think we'll continue to see that and have to work through those issues. Other than that, I've seen some employers who are requiring new hires. So they've made offers, job offers, but requiring their new hires to get tests to confirm that they're negative for COVID before starting their first day of work, which has been an interesting transition. And you know, it creates a clean slate. Your slate's only clean for as long as nobody is positive, but it's an interesting way to get started. And if you're a smaller employer, you may end up having to pay the FICRA leave kind of immediately if someone happens to be positive that you've rehired or hired. But it's an interesting trend that I'm seeing and something to consider as folks are reopening and going back into public-facing business.
Well, thank you very much, Jenna. And to all on the phone, we want to thank everybody for joining us today, especially our special guests, Dan Simons of Farmers Restaurant Group, Luke Holden of Luke's Lobster, and Congressman Earl Blumenauer. We'll be back again next week. Appreciate your ideas and any suggestions you have for topics. And things are getting back to business. Things are moving ahead, and we're going to get there stronger together. So everybody just hang in there, because help is on the way. As Winston Churchill said, never give up. And as Steve Perry said, don't stop believing. So we look forward to seeing you all next week. Have a great rest of the week. And thank you again for joining today.